in a boat now. Things got bad, now the boat won't float, I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working, we're not a working, we're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the November 1st, 2008 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you locally on WFT 90.1 FM and webcast worldwide at www.wft.org. I'm your host, David Johnson, here with co-host Tom Thomas, with this week's Cultural Corner poem, which is entitled Green, and Bob Plesney, our technical advisor, who will have some news and banner for us as well. Okay, the views and opinions you'll hear on WFT are those of the speakers and don't necessarily represent those of WFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Also, the Illinois Labor Hour is supported by the Illinois Education Teachers Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Okay, with no further ado, we will go with the news headlines here with Tom Thomas.
In Bajra, thousands of workers take to the streets in a demonstration against the government anti-workers policy. In a coordination effort with the Labor Unifying Bureau, thousands of workers from various industrial sectors took to the streets of Bajra on October 27, 2008, marching towards the municipal building where the officials' offices are to denounce the Ministry of Finance decrees that resulted in massive cutbacks in worker salaries. The workers came from steel, petrochemicals, paper, and other plants in Bajra, who were headed by Hassan Juma, head of the Labor Unifying Bureau and oil workers, and Abu Watan, vice president of Labor Unifying Bureau and GFWCUI in Bajra. It is noteworthy these demonstrations have intensified recently in many industrial sectors across Iraq, but the local and international media did not cover these events. Hey, a federal mediation service spokesman has announced that a tentative settlement was reached late last Monday to end a machinist strike that has shut down Boeing Aircraft's commercial airplane operations since September 6th. Frank Larkin, a spokesman for the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, told the Associated Press that the deal was reached in the fifth day of talks and the 52nd day of the walkout. The deal was confirmed by mediation service spokesman John Arnold, who told the AP, "We have a tentative agreement." Note the tentative is in quotations, meaning maybe or maybe not. In any event, the machinists are going back to work for the time being. The Holtwood Hydroelectric Dam on the Susquehanna River in southeastern Pennsylvania hasn't changed much since it first cranked up in 1910. Inside its long, narrow powerhouse, 10 hulking steel-encased generators emit a shrill hum, and from below comes a steady subway train-like rumble. The cascade of water down the plant's sloping walls before it hurtles into turbines at 240,000 gallons per second. Workhorses like the 109-megawatt Holtwood Dam, which powers over 90,000 homes in the region, have been criticized by some environmentalists for the hazards they present to fish. Yet those criticisms are all but forgotten amidst the rush to trendier forms of renewable energy, such as wind and solar. Hydropower, the oldest and by far most widely used form of alternative energy, is quietly making a comeback as a result of the scramble for clean energy and the high cost of fossil fuels. Pennsylvania Power and Light is investing $350 million to build a new powerhouse at Holtwood, the first new hydroelectric facility in the eastern U.S. in some 20 years. It will house just two sets of large turbines and generators, but will boast a capacity of 125 megawatts, enough to light more than 100,000 homes, thanks to new and more efficient technology. The Holtwood reconstruction is part of the nation's biggest hydropower expansion since the 1980s, and a number of utilities nationwide are proposing more than 70 projects across the nation that would boost U.S. hydroelectric capacity by 11% over the next decade. This from San Francisco. To settle a legal battle, Google reached an agreement with book publishers and authors that clears the way for both sides to more easily profit from digital versions of printed books. The agreement, under which Google would pay $125 million to settle two copyright lawsuits over its book scanning efforts, would allow it to make millions of out-of-print books available for reading and purchasing online. The agreement also outlines the framework for a new system that will channel payments from book sales, advertising revenue, and other fees to the author and publishers, with Google just collecting a cut. The deal is a major step toward drawing a roadmap for a possible digital future for publishers and authors who are worried that they are losing control over how their works were used. According to company executives, the Gannett Company, the U.S.'s largest newspaper chain, will be laying off about 10% of its workforce by early December. This announcement was made a few days after Gannett disclosed another sharp drop in its revenues and earnings. The layoffs will not apply to the company's flagship paper, USA Today, but will apply to the company's 84 other daily newspapers in the United States and more than 800 small, non-daily local papers. The announcement does not include Gannett's hundreds of small papers in Great Britain. Gannett declined to say specifically how many people would lose their jobs, but informed sources say the 10% figure translates to roughly 3,000 people in scattered and sundry locations. Gannett publishes some major papers like USA Today, the Arizona Republic, and the Detroit Free Press, but most of its publications are much smaller. And finally, while the U.S. major U.S. automakers lobby the government for some sort of bailout, industry watchers are bracing for a major failure of the auto parts supply base if one or more of the Detroit Three seek bankruptcy court protection. Already suffering auto parts suppliers would also be forced to seek the same protection or simply liquidate, as many have had to do this year. The Center for Automotive Research says bankruptcy filing by one or more of the domestic automakers could result in the loss of over 2 million jobs. According to David Cole, chairman of the Center for Automotive Research, who advocates that the government step in to assist U.S. automakers, any bankruptcy filing would take the industry down. A bailout would be a tiny amount compared to the consequences overall if this thing gets away from us. Last week, White House spokesman Dana Perino would not rule in or out new aid for American automakers. She said their financial units might be eligible to help through the $700 billion federal financial systems rescue, which is buying troubled assets. Meanwhile, companies supplying the automakers have seen profit margins dwindle from 3% in 2007 to less than 1% in 2008, according to SageWorks, a data firm that tracks privately held companies. Dave?
Well, I tell you, if there's going to be a bailout for the auto industry, then they need to turn over the majority shares of those companies to the workers in the
absolutely,
plants.
Absolutely, to the people that build our cars.
You know, I've been talking a lot about socialism here. I tell you, the real, of course, we had a show last week about what really is socialism, and this whole bailout that we've been experiencing is not socialism. It's a socialism is supposed to be a transfer of wealth in the society to those in most in need, and what we have is just the reverse. But anyway, we have three special guests in the studio today, since this is kind of our election program, and we'll get to them here in a moment. But I just wanted to, since it is an election year and everything, point out that there was a interesting election back in 1948. That was the independent candidacy of Henry Wallace. Henry Wallace was born in Orion, Iowa in 1933. Franklin Delano Roosevelt appointed him United States Secretary of Agriculture, and Wallace had been a liberal Republican, but he supported Roosevelt's New Deal and soon switched to the Democratic Party. And on May, he was also held a couple other positions in the Roosevelt administration until 1941. He was appointed the vice president. But anyway, Wallace in May of 1942, delivered his most famous speech, which became known by the phrase Century of the Common Man, to the Free World Association in New York, in a speech grounded in Christian references, laid out a positive vision for the war that was being fought then, beyond the simple defeat of the Nazis. And the speech in the book of the same name, which appeared the following year, proved quite popular, but it earned him enemies among the Democratic leadership, among important ally leaders like Winston Churchill, and among business leaders and conservatives as well. Wallace also spoke out during race riots in Detroit in 1943, declaring that the nation could not, quote, fight to crush Nazi brutality abroad and condone race riots at home. In 1943, Wallace made a goodwill tour of Latin America, shoring up support among allies so that they would support the Second World War on the side of the allies. And it was interesting, regarding trade relationships with Latin America, Wallace convinced the U.S. government to add labor clauses to contracts with Latin American producers. These clauses required producers to pay fair wages and provide safe working conditions for their employees, and committed the United States to paying for up to half of the required improvements. And this meant opposition from the U.S. Department of Commerce. But anyway, Wallace was knocked off the ticket, and Harry Truman became the Vice President of Roosevelt's last term. And then Wallace decided in 1948 to run an independent candidacy for president on the Progressive Party ticket. His platform advocated an end to segregation, full voting rights for blacks, and universal government health insurance. His campaign was unusual for its time, that included African-American candidates campaigning alongside white candidates, the American South, and that during the campaign, he refused to appear before segregated audiences or eat or stay in segregated establishments. Well, anyway, what's interesting is a local labor musician, troubadour, found this really obscure recording of a campaign song for Henry Wallace's campaign. And 1940 election was mainly between Truman and Harry Truman and Thomas Dewey, but the person with the most interesting songs belonged to the third party, and that was Harry Wallace. And some of his songs were the Battle Hymn of 48 to the tune of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and We Can Win with Wallace, the tune of Buckle Down Winsocky, and some interesting original songs were We Got the Ballot and The Same Old Merry-Go-Round by Ray Glazer and Bill Wolf, a tune that showed how the two main parties were dominating in politics, and they were basically the same. So we're going to play a little song as sort of an intro to our special guest. We're going to be playing The Same Old Merry-Go-Round, circa 1948.
Now the donkey is tired and thin. The elephant thinks he'll move in. They yell and they fuss, but they ain't fooling us, 'cause their brother's right under the skin. It's the same merry-go-round. Which one will you ride this year? The donkey and elephant bob up and down on the same merry-go-round.
Beep, 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 beep.
Now the elephant comes from the north. The donkey may come from the south, but don't let them fool you, divide you and rule you, 'cause they've got the same bit in the mouth. It's the same merry-go-round. Which one will you ride this year? The donkey and elephant bob up and down on the same merry-go-round.
Okay, folks, I hope you enjoyed that little song there. But anyway, fast forward now 60 years from 1948 to 2008, and we have our special guests here in the studio, and I'd like to each of them to introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Mike Lehman. I'm running for county board in District 9 as a Green.
I'm Joe Futrell, and I'm running for Champaign County Board in District 8 with the Green Party.
And I'm Walter Pitzek, and I'm running for Champaign County Board in District 7 with the Greens.
Okay, well, thanks for coming in the show. We're honored to have you here today. And what's real interesting about these three gentlemen running here, local county board on the Green Party ticket, is that they just recently got an endorsement from the Champaign County AFL-CIO. And this has got to be, this is definitely a precedent-setting event. I don't know of anywhere else in the country that where the local Central Labor Council has endorsed the Green Party for office. But anyway, I'll just turn over the mics here and let each of them just talk a little bit about their campaign. We'll start with you, Mike.
Okay, just a little clarification there. AFL-CIO actually supports us. They don't do endorsements as a group anyway. Individual unions do endorse candidates. So all three of us are actually getting financial support from the AFL-CIO, and we appreciate that. I'm actually, myself, I was endorsed by AFSCME here.
Okay, and Joe?
Hi, so I ran already in 2006, and at that point I had never run for office before. It was a new thing for me, and the Champaign County government and the issues there were new. But this time I've learned so much, and I've been doing a lot of canvassing. I've been canvassing for months now, and when I talk to people, I'm getting a much more positive vibe than I was in 2006. I think people have seen that the problems that we were having with financing the nursing home construction have turned into problems with financing the nursing home's operation, and that this has all happened under the watch of the Democratic majority. So people are looking for somebody who is going to have his eye on the ball, and I've been attending the meetings. I have a lot of specific things to say about it, which I won't go into right now because I'm just introducing myself. But I got a strong message in 2006 that there were people who wanted to vote for me, and I took that as a sign that I should campaign real hard this time and try to get a win. And I think I'm on my way to it.
Okay, and Walter.
Yeah, I think this is a fertile ground this year for the Greens. Especially in Champaign County. We ran two previous elections in 2004 and 2006, and you know, we have the infrastructure in place, and you know, people usually they are, some people think of the Greens as this fringe party, but not here in Champaign County. We're scoring up 20-25% of the vote in three-way races. So we have a chance this year to have a three-member caucus on the Champaign County void for a voice for labor and progressive voice for people of Champaign County.
Okay, well, isn't it the fact that the Green Party is the third largest political party in the United States right at the moment?
I think so, but the other thing that we like to tell people is that the Green Party is the biggest party in the world because it's an international movement, and there are Green Parties all over the world, mm-hmm. some of which have are actually participating in coalition governments and wielding a lot of influence, in particular in Ireland, in New Zealand, places like that. There's a fairly loose coordination between those parties because the political systems are so different and the political conditions are so different in those countries, but they're all informed by the same set of values: social justice, nonviolence, environmental wisdom, and grassroots democracy. And what we're doing here locally is what Green parties have done to reach those positions of influence in those other countries. You start at the local level, you build yourself up, you win some races, you establish yourself as credible public servants. That causes people to realize that, hey, you know, the Green Party is, again, it's not a fringe environmental club. These are people, these are our neighbors, these are working people, they want to represent us, and you build up from there. And that's what third parties have done here in the United States in our distant history to establish themselves. It's what the Republicans did in the 19th century, and it can be done. You just have to be willing to go up against a system that's stacked against you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and of course, we know in this this political system we have with the Electoral College and a lot of these other arcane rules, ballot access and all that, which makes it really difficult for any kind of third party to get on the ballots in the individual states, that's definitely an understatement. What I think is interesting is a lot of people out there, I'd say the vast majority, are really disillusioned and upset. It seems like you know, they vote you know, for the Democrats all the time, you know, especially in labor. People are, you know, working people and people especially belong to unions, thinking that they're the party of the working person, and then they get in, especially at the national level and even at the local level occasionally, and nothing changes. And it seems like the same policies go forward, the same anti-working person, the same anti-labor, and, of course, anti-environment, which, of course, environmental issues, as far as I'm concerned, are working class issues, because you look at environmental poisons and environmental impacts affect the poor and the working class. The wealthy can go and afford to live in a gated community somewhere with a pristine environment, but the poor and working class can't. Now, two of the three of you are union members, too, and that's what I also find interesting here. And so I'd like maybe to three of you to maybe talk a little bit about what you do. Now, Walter, you're a student, but that's as far as I'm concerned, that's a job because that requires a lot of time and effort, and it's a career too. You know, so I don't want to leave you out here. You're, as far as I'm concerned, you're a worker as well. So, but maybe each of the three of you could talk a little bit about why is it you decided to. I'm sure you got better things to do out there because you know running any kind of campaign requires a lot of time and energy and money. So maybe you could just talk a little about what compelled you to run.
Well, as far as labor goes, I think it's part of a, sort of a new trend. I think one thing to keep in mind is that labor has traditionally supported Democrats because, in part, Democrats have served some of labor's goals. But, you know, it seems like Democrats have treated labor increasingly as if it's irrelevant or just, you know, some small part of the bigger equation. I think this can be seen also in another local contest where a Green is running. It's in Coles County, Charleston. There's a fellow named Todd Reardon who's running for state's attorney there. And there was a letter from somebody in Teamsters 26 that was in the local paper. And he said, well, the Republican who's the incumbent, he's no friend to labor. That's obvious. There's a Democrat running against him who apparently held office before, but he had people arrested for picketing during the Trailmobile strike, I think it was. So the fellow from Teamsters 26 said he's no friend of labor either, so they're supporting the Green candidate here, who I think Joe got 19% the last time he ran. Is that correct? In Charleston?
Todd?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
Oh, okay, so, you know, there you're about ready to break through, and people are starting to see, you know, which side is your bread buttered on, so to speak. I myself have been a longtime labor supporter before I got back into academia. I'm currently a doctoral candidate in history at the U of I, but I returned to school because I got fired in a union dispute out at Super Value and decided I'll go back to school. And in that time, I've since become a member of a labor union, Graduate Employees Organization, GEO as most people know it. I've been a member since I started in grad school because we teach and also do various kinds of assistance to scholars and stuff like that. We're regular working folks, even though we are in academia. I also served for 2 years as the GEO grievance officer.
Okay, Jill.
Well, I've done labor activism for a long time because, like a lot of Greens, I was an issue activist before I got into electoral politics. We have people from a lot of different movements in the Greens. We have people from the environmental movement. We have people from the social justice movements and things like that. For me, I started out as a anti-war protester and doing protest activism, and I started feeling like I wanted to get involved in democracy. And so I started working with unions. I did some work with the AAP when they were just getting started, did some canvassing there to see if I liked that.
And what is it? Can you tell our listeners what the AAP is?
The AAP is the Association of Academic Professionals.
And it's affiliated with the IEA Teachers
Union? It's an IEA-NEA affiliated union that represents academic professionals at the University of Illinois.
And you're a member of that union then?
I'm a member of that union.
Academic professional, okay.
Yeah, AAP represents staff members that aren't faculty. And that actually is about 2,500 people, I think. Something on that order, 2,500, 3,000 people at the university. And there's a number of grievances that remain unaddressed there. They typically work on one-year contracts with basically no job security, and they don't have a path to professional advancement. Like a lot of academic professionals, I was in a situation where my boss wanted to give me a raise, and they weren't able to do that because my job classification didn't allow for that. And so I had to resign and get rehired with a search to my new position, and there wasn't even a position that allowed them to pay me what they wanted to pay me, so they had to create a new job description and a new position and go through all this. That's what passes for career development if you're an AP. And a lot, I'm lucky. A lot of AAPs are stuck in more of a dead end situation where there isn't a path forward. But anyway, so I got involved in that, and then I started thinking that it would be more effective to get involved in trying to get some people elected who believe in doing things for working people. And I'm very glad that we're running Mike Lehman, because Mike worked very hard on the living wage campaign, and we believe very strongly in full employment at a living wage, and we think that it should apply at the county level, at the municipal level, at the state level, at the national level, and in every workplace in the United States, because we can't really have any economy if people aren't paid enough to afford the things they need.
Oh, indeed. And Walter, what made you decide to run this year?
Well, I am not a a union member right now because I'm a student, but I'm studying to be a high school history teacher. So hopefully I'll be part of some union education teacher union, the IEA or the IFT. I decided to run with the Greens because of my interest in social justice and environmental issues. I read a book called Environmental Equalities, which talked about the environmental degradation in Gary, Indiana, when those steel workers and smelt workers lived in these communities where the steel companies came in, they built their factories then around these neighborhoods, the working class neighborhoods, and they forgot about them. They didn't have any scrubbers on those smokestacks. They basically thought, hey, we can dump on these people because they're politically disempowered, so we can get away with it. But I think today, it's certainly at this time, labor and environmental issues certainly merge on a lot of issues, whether it be quality of life issues, clean water, clean air, decent wage and living. That's all I got.
Well, I should say at the county level that there are some issues with the Democrats with respect to labor. There is a certain contingent in the Democratic Party who, in response to some of the budget issues with the nursing home, the first thing they want to look at is renegotiating the contract of the union workers at the nursing home. And we've taken a stand against that. I've gotten up at county board meetings and said, look, this is not the way to solve this problem. If you really think that labor costs are the big factor here, you're not reading the numbers and you're not looking at the budget.
Yeah, that's Friends of Labor, huh? So hold that thought, Joe, because I definitely, when we come back here, I want to really get into the depth of some of these issues on the nursing home and everything. But anyway, next, with no further ado, Tom Thomas's poem of the week, which it sounds like he wrote this just with you guys in mind. It's entitled Green.
Green is the color of nature, for all that is green contains life. Green is the party to go with to deliver us from our strife. Green are the plains and the mountains flourishing beneath the blue sky. Green is the flower ere it blooms, and more luscious colors are nigh. Green is the seed of a nation that lives as a community. Green are the true patriots' hearts who side by side will keep us free. Planting our ballots in that box, let them be green seeds that'll grow. Let's get some folks with morals in the next congressional roll. Green is the color of springtime, when all kinds of new life is born, when crickets chirp and starlings sing, and a nation can be reborn. Let's vote our green candidates in, and the Demopublicans out. Let's show the crooks that are in now what our Constitution's about. Green is the color of nature, for all that is green contains life. Green is the party to go with to deliver us from our strife. Written at the Poet's Loft in Champaign, Illinois on October 31st, 2008, the poem Green was first recited live November 1st, 2008 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois. Thank you for listening.
Okay, we got some public service announcements here. Today, November 1st from 2 to 4 p.m. At the Mall Neal, it says here the Mall at Neal downtown Champaign is the monthly protest for the anti-war and racism effort. Turn out if you can today. Nice day for it. And also this coming Thursday, November 6th at 7 p.m. at the Independent Media Center, the film screening of Winter Soldier 2, Iraq and Afghanistan.
And you can support a variety of local organizations like WEFT 90.1 FM at the Pages for All Ages community-wide book fair through Sunday, November 2nd. When checking out, Pages will donate 15% of your purchase to community radio when you mention WEFT. Pages is located on South Neal and Curtis Road, south of the Savoy 16 Theater. For more information, click on pagesforallages.com. And you can still join WEFT this Saturday and every Saturday at Urbana's Market at the Square. We'll be there from 8 until noon. Stop by, say hello, and find out what community radio is all about.
Okay, and one last public service announcement here. Next Saturday, November 8th, in Chicago, will be the Industrial Workers of the World 2008 Midwest WOB Fest. And that's located at the UE Hall on 37 South Ashland in Chicago. And it's going to be a two-day event, going most of the day Saturday, as well as on Sunday. They're going to be having some tours of some historical labor places like Waldheim Cemetery, where the Haymarket Martyrs are buried, as well as the Pullman and Pinkerton graves, those infamous characters in labor history, and also a visit Carlos Cortez's tour. It'll take place at the Museum of Mexican Culture and History in Pilsen, which is the more or less the Mexican neighborhood of near south side of Chicago. So check out some of those if you can, and we'll be right back, and we're going to be playing another song from the 1948 Henry Wallace campaign.
Blowing all across this mighty land, and it sings of peace and progress and prosperity at hand, with security and plenty for the people to command, for the people's march is on. Glory, glory, hallelujah! Glory, glory, hallelujah! The city, all the nation's voice has roared. Down the rivers, across the prairies, like a torrent it has poured. We will march with Henry Wallace, we will fight with Gideon's sword, for the people's march is on. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Okay, that was a battle hymn of 1948 sung by Paul Robeson. And anyway, before we go back here to our candidates, Bob Plesney has a little Labor Hour reporter update from an event that happened this last week. Bob?
Yes, the MillerCom put on a talk, and Naomi Klein talked about her book, Shock Doctrine, and it was really interesting. I found her very knowledgeable. I was impressed with their knowledge of economic issues and the history of economists, her history of the Milton Friedman, the Chicago School, the Austrian School. People were able to ask questions of her, and her depth of knowledge about these economic issues was amazing. And also how the effects it had on Latin America, how they've used Latin America as somewhat of a classroom or lab to experiment with some of these Milton Friedman and Chicago Boys theories, both in Chile, Argentina, and just the different things about how there's a lot of different shocks involved, shocks of unemployment, shocks of overthrows of government, and how the community organized down there and the people got together, would meet under street lamps and discuss things which you wouldn't think that normal neighbors would talk about, such as how the economy affected them, whether they should be nationalizing industries and things like that. It was quite an impressive talk.
Wow, it sounds relevant at this point in time for sure. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Bob. And let's get back to our candidates here. And okay, let's get right into the meat of the matter here. There's been some really contentious issues here. Joe, you kind of did a little intro to it here right before the musical and cultural corner break about the nursing home. Let's start with Mike, and he can kind of, you know, talk a little bit about it, and then we'll go Joe and then Walter here. And I don't want to disliminate ourselves in nursing home, but I think this has been a really, really important issue. So, Mike?
Well, as Joe mentioned, I first got interested in what's going on at the nursing home back during the Living Wage campaign, which I helped found and was the coordinator for. The Living Wage was passed by the county board in 2002, and then they immediately turned around and they put two referendums on the ballot. One was to raise bonds to build a new nursing home, which was a good thing. They needed an improved facility. It's hard to tell whether it's as energy efficient as maybe it could have been, but it's a new facility now that they have out there. There's been a number of issues with that construction of it. The other referendum was to put a 3 cent per hundred property tax on to help support the nursing home. Now, what they didn't tell you or didn't make too much of was that basically the 3 cents, all of a sudden what they did was they took the nursing home employees' retirement and Social Security funds and split those off from the rest of the county departments. So like the sheriff's department, roads, all the rest of it, they're all in there and they're paid out of the property tax as part of the general corporate funding. But for some reason, they wanted to put the nursing home folks in their own special category, and not only that, to make a special tax that pretty much goes just towards paying for their retirement and Social Security. There's been a lot of talk about how bad the nursing home is, about, you know, needing loans and things like that. But if you look at the facts there, the property tax that they get is about $900,000 a year. And basically, $800,000 of that, the largest majority of it, goes towards paying that Social Security and retirement fund. So if you look at what the subsidy really is, it's only about $100,000 a year. And if you look at the whole history of this thing, they borrowed about $2.8 million from the general fund until they couldn't borrow anymore. Now, that's one of the things. My opponent, he's been on the finance committee there, Brendan McGinty. He's a Democrat, and, you know, he's had somebody, you know, a couple of the other Democrats sing his praises in a recent letter to the editor to the effect that, oh, well, he's managing this well. Well, you know, I don't want to put it all on him. He's only one person amongst 27. And I also don't want to put it all on Democrats, because the Republicans are in there and they have failed in their oversight too. And I think this is one example where having Greens in there would help get to the bottom of this mess, because both parties spend a lot of time trying to point the finger at the other person instead of doing the business of the people. So, and that's where you get these charges, well, there's a subsidy and things like that. There actually is hardly any subsidy at all, and what there is goes to pay for the retirement, since they decided to split that off from the other department. So what it gets down to is, after they've done all the belt tightening they can, and of course we know that usually hurts the little guy worse, you've either got a revenue gap that has to be filled, or you increase your revenue. Now, you know, I'm hoping that once they get the book straightened out, and that's another problem because nobody really knows what's going on over there, that they keep saying it's horrible, but they never can come up with the numbers, okay? And I don't think it's that bad. You look at it, the nursing home has about a $16 million a year budget currently. And if you're talking about $100,000 of it being the effective subsidy, if you want to call it a subsidy, that's a tiny fraction of the whole thing. They wouldn't close the sheriff's department if they had like a 3% gap in its budget. They wouldn't close the roads department if they had a 3% gap in their budget. They wouldn't do any of that. But for some reason, the nursing home is a special situation that they're, you know, I think the real plan is they're hoping to privatize it on the backs of the taxpayers. They wanted to build a brand new nursing home, the Democratic leadership over there. So they got a nice new facility. Then they're going to run the finances into the ground. And then they're going to turn around and say, oh, well, we've got to sell this. And then somebody's going to get a sweetheart deal. This is Illinois, remember. So there's really a lack of accountability. And I think that's one thing that I, as a Green, and any of the other Greens, should we get elected, that is something that is going to be one of our first things that we want to do. We want to say, show me the money, okay? Just to use a really lame phrase, but nobody has really gotten the statistics there. And they even say currently, the last report from the management folks over there was, well, we don't quite know enough to go to actually detail the cash flow. Well, somebody's going to have to do this sooner or later. Let's put it this way, folks. And the whole thing is they can't get rid of the nursing home. It's not just a matter of closing the doors. The assistant state's attorney came in there when they were discussing this stuff earlier last summer and said, to do that, you not only have to have everybody on the board, practically, in other words, a supermajority, I think it's 60%, but it's well more than half, has to agree to put a question on the ballot, and then the people have to vote on that. I think what the voters have said before, and what's being ignored, is we want the nursing home, we want it run right. And we've got the nursing home, but whether we get it run right is going to depend very much on some other leadership than the leadership we've had out there so far.
Now, this nursing home that's been a basically a public asset since sometime in the early part of the 1900s. Is that correct?
Yep, 100 years it's been in operation. Now, as a nursing home, it started out as a poor farm, okay, which is sort of a different concept. But the county has always subsidized this institution. In the 50s, it was converted to a nursing home. And ever since then, most of the what runs it comes from grants like Medicaid, Medicare. Of course, we know the problems with the feds and down in Springfield, and that's a whole mess and it's on its own. But I think the people here in this county, Champaign County, have said repeatedly, we want the nursing home. We want it supported. We want an institution where anybody, no matter what their financial circumstances are, can find care when they're in the neediest and most vulnerable parts of their life.
You know, from listening to Carol Amons and Aaron Amons' show, Higher Ground, there was a guest on that was talking about some of the history of the county nursing home. And for years and years, I mean, it had been in very good financial shape. And in fact, at times, the county, from what they were saying, was it actually borrowed money from the nursing home fund to when the county got in trouble. So talk about a la Naomi Klein here. I mean, when I started hearing a lot of this stuff, it sounded like just the recipe for running. You know, this is so, the script here has been played over and over again where, you know, you get people in there, they run a public institution in the ground, and then try to you know say, well, we need to privatize as a justification to save it, when in fact it's like you referred to, Mike, just a second ago, as some kind of sweetheart political deal for some private entity. Joe, I know Mike really got into that, so could you and Walter would like to add a few things to the nursing home issue here?
Well, sure. I mean, that's exactly what I said to the board during this election season. I got up and said, look, you guys are trying to privatize this home, and there's absolutely no reason to do that. It would basically be selling off a really, really important asset that the voters wanted at fire sale prices for zero benefit to anybody. Again, I mean, just think about the numbers that Mike was talking about. If your effective subsidy is $100,000 out of a $120 million county budget, we can prioritize taking care of these Medicaid recipients, right? It's something that the voters wanted. And the reason that I'm running against somebody who represents the Democratic Party for the board is that the Democratic Party hasn't been paying attention. This whole process that we're talking about has been moving forward, and it sort of caught them unawares. And so when it came time to do something about it, the only thing they could think about were the shortest-term solutions, the shortest-term remedies, which have to do with layoffs and trying to renegotiate that contract to bring down what they're being told is a significant cost, because they don't have the consistent set of books in front of them. And so one of the things that I've done is call for an independent investigation into the books. We had a volunteer independent investigation into the books when Professor Rachel Schwartz of the University of Illinois started independently looking at the books and coming up with things that the MPA, the contractor that's running the home, said, we're glad you did that because it would have taken us a while to find that. And it's like the county board members who are running this thing should already know all of this stuff. And so we need people on the board who are paying attention, who understand that it's a priority to keep this home open, and who are going to get to the bottom of this. Now, the other thing I'll say about this whole process is that we need that consistent set of books, but we also have to have some priorities. This is not just a nursing home either. It also provides rehabilitation services. It's excellent. And we need to look at it in context. Other county nursing homes in Illinois are not doing badly. And we pretty much know the reason why ours in particular is doing badly, which is that we can't retain nurses, full-time nurses. 85% of them don't make it past the probationary period. They get dismissed for the smallest infractions. And as a result, you know, for whatever reason, right? I mean, they don't get dismissed without cause. There's something going on there. And from what I've heard, the work environment there is just a little strict.
And that didn't used to be the case. When I understand the history, the nursing home used to be one of the best employers in the county as far as you know, nursers and other staff.
There's something about the relationship between the administration of the nursing home and the full time nurses that's kind of on the rocks at the moment. And the response to that situation has been that there is a nursing shortage and that we need to fill the gaps with contract nursing, and that the contract nurses are what, 40% more expensive or something like that? It's a significant expense. It's one of the largest costs on the books of the nursing home. And these contract nurses are a transient population. They're going after, they get bonuses. And so this is attractive for nurses to become contract nurses. But what you get is you get an itinerant nursing population. You get a lot of turnover, and the quality of care, frankly, suffers as a result of that. And the solution to that is to create is unfortunately, and this is not something you can point at on a balance sheet. The solution is this intangible of creating a positive working environment for these nurses, so that they not only won't be dismissed for small infractions, but there will be some kind of process by which they'll become better employees. They'll feel like their work is valued. They'll want to stay, because we can't compete in terms of providing the kind of income for these nurses that they could get at Carle or any of these other institutions. Mm-hmm. We have to provide good working conditions, because that's the only thing that long-term is going to get that big cost off the books of the nursing home. So if we're talking about cutting costs, the first thing that – and everybody really agrees on this. When they look at the cost of this contract nursing, Republicans, Democrats, board members, the administration say we need to reduce contract nursing. But the reality is there's some intangible working conditions issues, and if the board keeps talking about wanting to cut labor costs and renegotiate the contract, then you imagine what it must feel like for the workers there, and we hear this from them. Everybody's dumping on them. The administration's dumping on them. The board's dumping on them. The members of the public who are more Republican-leaning are dumping on them, saying they're the problem. And that's just not looking at the context, because we can be like DeKalb, or we can be like one of these other counties. Mm-hmm. Where we don't have a financial problem with our nursing home. It just requires work and commitment to making it a good place to work.
Okay, Walter, you want to add your thoughts on this too?
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree with what Mike and Joe said previously. I think part of the solution is just the management of the nursing home. From what I'm hearing from nurses at the county nursing home, they're working in a hostile working environment. They're not happy with the current management situation, especially with this MPA, I think Management Professional...
Performance Association,
who was hired by the county board to oversee the finances of the and management of the nursing home. So, in essence, we have sort of a de facto private entity running our county nursing home, which is a dangerous step towards.
Yet there's still an administrator that's on salary, though.
Right.
In addition to the privatized outsourced management, that's ridiculous. When I first heard that, I just thought that was unbelievable.
It's very interesting, because not only is that former administrator, he's not the employee of the county anymore. He's the employee of MPA, this private company. So
I see. Okay. All right. Okay. We're going to take a real short musical break here, and we're going to come back and kind of do a wrap up here on some other issues. Even though this nursing home one is a very it's a little complex, but it's a very critical issue, and I'm just really glad that somebody's taking the lead on this. Thank you so much, candidates, for going to all these county board meetings, which I know are not the most exciting things in the world and everything. But anyway, we'll be right back. Yes, indeed. That was Depeche Mode with Policy of Truth. I thought it was an appropriate song to play today. And yes, things used to seem a lot more civilized than they are today. And so anyway, we're back here with Mike Lehman, Joe Futrell, and Walter Patuk. And we would like just to spend the last few minutes here of the Labor Hour for them to kind of touch on some of the other issues, even though this nursing home one is, as Joe said during the music break, the ground zero of labor issues here in the county. But anyway, there's some other important issues out there, too, and I'd just like each of them to kind of just talk a little bit about. So, Mike?
Well, you know, we're not just one issue here, too, and I think that's an important thing for people to keep in mind. One of the other issues that's of concern to us is the justice system here in Champaign County. As anybody who looks at statistics can tell, there's great racial disparities here, and whatever the cause is, there's something going on with that. I think, quite frankly, you know, it was interesting. News Gazette sent us a questionnaire and had several leading questions on the nursing home. And then it got down there and asked, what do you want to do about the downtown jail? And I said, I would close it, basically, is what it gets down to. And I said, you know, anybody that can mention closing the nursing home or selling it off and building a bigger jail in practically the same breath, that's problematic. Let's put it this way. But that's the way they tend to think over there at the News Gazette on their editorial board. If you look at the columns that they put out, quite frankly, I think they ought to close the downtown jail. They ought to come up with alternatives to incarceration. This is a failed policy. A lot of it's driven by the drug war and things like that. And I think what we really need to do is consider things like home incarceration. They don't use that nearly as much as that could be. They got a drug court program, and while I have some conceptual issues with the whole drug war, you know, and then the drug court coming in there, they actually aren't fully funding that. They could be keeping people out of jail if they spent a little bit more money on drug court. While they spend, I think it's about $30,000 that they're going to have into it next year, and I'm sure the jail, I'm trying to remember what exactly it was, runs into the millions of dollars. It would be much better for us as a community to have alternatives to incarceration. And one of the things could be, let's just close a downtown jail, go with what we got out there, and that would cut some expenses there. That money could be refunneled into options to incarceration.
I think it's important for people to realize that Greens really have an agenda that crosses all kinds of issues. Again, because we believe in environmental wisdom, but we also believe in social justice, grassroots democracy, and nonviolence. One issue that I ran on very strongly in 2006, and that I'm running on again, is doing something about urban sprawl. Urban sprawl we see as a long-term issue. It affects county policy, it affects municipal policy, it affects state policy, and really, I think the high cost of gas and fuel is causing people to rethink how we've organized our cities into widely spread out areas, some of which are just commercial and don't have any kind of schools or other infrastructure. And as a result, people have to drive a lot. There's new kinds of development that we can do where we urbanize. We build up instead of out in the cities. We have mixed use facilities like some of the new construction that's going on here at the old Burnham area. That's going to have a grocery store on the first floor, easy walking distance to campus, so people can live, shop, and go to school in a very compact area. At the county level, I think we need a new comprehensive zoning ordinance to address some of these issues. It's very difficult for the county and the cities to negotiate on new kinds of urban planning with the zoning ordinance that's already in place. And I should say that the failure of the comprehensive zoning ordinance recently has been one of the things that the Democrats were unable to achieve. They have a majority, but in practical terms, they were outmaneuvered by the Republicans, who required a supermajority and required that the whole zoning ordinance be voted on at once. There were good things in that zoning ordinance. The Farm Bureau supported it. Green supported it. It was going to provide stream buffers to prevent agricultural runoff from getting into our streams. It provided some contiguous green spaces, and we thought it was a reasonable accommodation. We think that even more could be done, because Greens like to think really long term. We like to think about a post-oil future. where we're not going to have cheap gas so that we can drive our Hummer to Meijer anymore. We're going to have to locate. We're going to have smaller shops nearby. We're going to have to walk and bike. And we think that the zoning ordinance has to reflect that instead of being a decades-old thing.
You know, my wife's a German national. Being to Germany and Europe several times over my lifetime, it's amazing. It seems like here there's no planning. That's what it seems like. I mean, compared to Europe, everything is – it seems like they do a really detailed plan. I mean, you've got people – they're real creative. I mean, they've got a lot more people per square mile than we do.
Well, what we have here at the county level is not planning but visioning. And we had that process with Big Small All where people get together and they say what their vision is. And when you do this, and this has been done all over the place, you get the same things. We want a nice place to live. We want clean air. We want clean water. But that process fell apart because the Chamber of Commerce walked out because it didn't meet their development goals.
Gee.
And so visioning is not enough. We need people elected who
actually
have this
do
vision.
It. And Walter, could you tell us about some of the issues that you've been concerned about?
One issue that two issues that sort of intertwined that I'm running on is transparency and empowering citizenship. You know, one of the tenets of Green Party's grassroots and participatory democracy. I think in America, especially America and local level, we have this democracy deficit. We have people disengaged with the political process for other people, and a lot of these people are people of color and people of lower socioeconomic status. And one thing that I want to do on the county board is incorporate more principles of open government, direct democracy, putting more power in the hands of citizens, and that means giving them power to make legislation through initiative and referendum, and having the ability to recall their politicians. I think especially here in Illinois at the state level where we have an unpopular governor unanimously disliked by everyone, recall would solve that. We have recall in about 18 states, I think, in America, and so it's not a foreign idea. We can easily implement it here at the state level and at the local level.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, listen, I want to thank you for coming in today, and good luck on the elections. And, Mike just pointed out something to me, and I was going to mention that. Thank you, Mike, for reminding me, because I heard it on the way in on the previous show, News of Neptune, that Studs Terkel died, and was 96 years old, and he was a great he started out his career out in radio, but he later a great writer, a lot of books. In fact, I think we could probably do a whole show on him sometime here in the future in the labor hour. But anyway, good luck, gentlemen, and thank you so much for coming in, and sometime we'll have to, maybe after elections are over, have you come back and kind of do a post-election analysis or something, whatever you guys would like to do.
Thanks.
Thank you. We're going to be leaving you with a song by a local band with Darren Druda, Paul Kodheimer, called Demo Crazy.
See?